Today I'm going to start with reading a passage from a text called Shobo Genzo by a person named Dogen. And first I'm just going to read a part of a very short chapter. So I'm going to read it all the way through. It'll take a couple minutes. Because a Buddha is in birth and death, there is no birth and death. It is also said, because a Buddha is not in birth and death, a Buddha is not deluded by birth and death. If you search for a Buddha outside birth and death, it will be like trying to go to the southern country of Yue with your spear heading towards the north. Or like trying to see the Big Dipper while you are facing south. You will cause yourself to remain all the more in birth and death and lose the way of emancipation. Just understand that birth and death is itself nirvana. There is nothing such as birth and death to be avoided. There is nothing such as nirvana to be sought. Only when you realize this are you free from birth and death. It is a mistake to suppose that birth turns into death. Birth is a phase that is an entire period of itself, with its own past and future. For this reason, in Buddha Dharma, birth is understood as no birth. This birth and death is the life of Buddha. If you try to exclude it, you will lose the life of Buddha. If you cling to it, trying to remain in it, you will also lose the life of Buddha. And what remains will be the mere form of Buddha. Only when you don't dislike birth and death or long for them do you enter Buddha's mind. There's a simple way to become Buddha. When you refrain from unwholesome actions, are not attached to birth and death, and are compassionate toward all sentient beings, respectful to seniors and kind to juniors, not excluding or desiring anything, with no designing thoughts or worries, you will be called a Buddha. Do not seek anything else. Well, first of all, I'll go back and like to look in more detail about these words. But first I'd like to talk about three terms that come up in this passage about what they might mean. The first is, what does he mean when he says birth and death? Because he says that through the whole thing. So what does that mean? That's one thing we'll look at. Another thing is, what does he mean when he says Buddha? What does that mean? And the other thing is, what does he mean when he says nirvana? These are the things I think we look at some detail and try to explain and read again. Maybe the passage will go deeper into us. When we human beings call something birth or call something death, there's a particular thing that we think about. And it's called the birth of our baby. When that event happens, that's the ultimate meaning of the word birth for us. Because that's the most intimate event that we, in our ordinary lives, connect with. And it's beyond any kind of description. We call that thing birth. That's our ultimate birth. Likewise, death is the death of that same child, sometime or later. That's the most painful experience we can have, to lose our baby. The most joyous thing we can experience is to create one. And the most painful one is to lose it. Those are the things we call birth and death. Now there's zillions of other things that are birth and death as well. Tiny, tiny little things. Those are the gigantic things. But it's all a continuum. There's such things as the birth of an emotion, of a feeling, of a thought. It arises. Birth simply means the arising of something out of previous conditions. And death means the vanishing of something out of previous conditions. So, in actuality, if we look closely at something, we can't really find a moment that's really called birth, though. All birth really is just a very rapid changing of events from our human time perspective. Things are changing very rapidly. For instance, we know that when a baby comes out of the womb, that's what we call birth in our society. In other societies, it's a year earlier than that. But just because it comes out of the womb, we know a lot of stuff has been going on before that, right? It's not just like something spontaneously happened, out of nothing. There were conditions and causes prior to that. So we know that can't actually be birth. I mean, as arising out of nothing. Correct? So we might look back another previous 9 months and say, in our human world, and say, well, something happened then that was birth. But we might say there's something called an egg and something called a sperm. But those things had their own lives. They were alive, living. They came together under certain conditions and something changed. Something just changed. But it's not like something arose out of nothing. There were causes and conditions that created this event that we call birth. When I was 18, I took a biology course, and something struck me that I remember. And it was an idea that was prevalent in, I'm not sure when, maybe the 1700s or 16 or 18, something around there. It was called spontaneous generation, in which it was a scientific belief that something could arise out of nothing, just spontaneously arise. This was a scientific theory. It came from, I remember studying biology, it came from the idea of, I remember one part of the name, Drosophila. Does anyone remember that name? They're fruit flies. Fruit flies. People would see fruit flies, and they'd say, where'd they come from? they came out of no place. And that's what it appears from our human perspective, that they just arose out of nothingness. So they postulated, well, there's got to be spontaneous generation. Something can generate itself out of nothing. Well, after time went by, and we developed more sophisticated ways of seeing in ways that our human eye can't see, they said, well, wait, something was going on there that we can't see with just our ordinary eye. So it wasn't spontaneous generation. So I learned in that biology class when I was 18 in the scientific community, that idea doesn't hold. Something always arises out of other conditions. And this is what the Buddha taught, basically. It's dependent origination, you might have heard. It means nothing originates or comes out of just itself. It comes from prior conditions and causes. So another thing we can call birth is our joy. the joyful events we have in our life. Death we can call our grief and sorrow. So that's a little bit about birth and death. But birth and death is tiny, too. If you sit zazen, and a lot of us just did, how many births and deaths occur in one period of zazen? Billions. And if you're aware of billions of them occurring, you're an advanced student. When I used to teach zazen, I don't teach it very often anymore, but particularly to new people, they would complain, something like, "Oh, I couldn't keep my mind still for even a moment. It was just going boom, 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 boom." They'd sort of say, "I had to bring my mind back like I don't know how many times." Well, that's advanced practice. What isn't advanced practice is if you bring your mind back twice. What does that mean? If you bring your mind back twice, it means where have you been? Just floating around in the universe, really. Don't you think? You're floating in your own individual consciousness somewhere, dreaming up some story about reality. But it's not reality. It's just your own consciousness creating something. It's not the reality that all of us are in. It's just your own reality. And there's a certain way in which when we only reside in our own reality, our life is very limited. Nobody has a sense that they're connected to us because we're residing in our own world. So our practice, the practice is how do we just bring our mind back to this place we live in right here, right now. That's the only practice we do forever and ever. It's kind of boring. And there's really nothing more we're saying about it now than we did 30 years ago. It's just how do we bring our minds back here to this place that we live in. So then let's talk about... Buddha, what does Buddha mean? He uses Buddha all the time. In the day and age where when he lived, most people were Buddhist. Most people were Buddhist. Different from our cultural situation, where most people aren't Buddhist in our society, our culture. So he's trying to actually show and explain to people what does this word Buddha mean? Because people in his day and age maybe got some really erroneous ideas about what Buddha means. About it being like something glorious and wonderful, that kind of thing. And not connected to our immediate world. You understand what I mean? It's like this big, gigantic thing floating in the air that's different from the ordinary life I have to live. That's what Buddha means. So he's trying to show it's not that. That's not what Buddha is. There's another person, and maybe I'll get to a little story about him too, but he said his name was Joshu, and he simply said, "I hate it when people say the word Buddha." He was a Buddhist. It means we're using this term in all kinds of ways that go this way and go that way. And say it's kind of useless. Kind of getting caught in our ideas about what Buddha means. So what's nirvana? Nirvana just means basically our deepest wish, our deepest desire for contentment in this world we live in which we have come into this situation where we have been born and where we die. How do we resolve that as human beings? How do we resolve that thing of the impermanence? The awareness that we are not here forever. We are just here in these conditions for a very limited amount of time. How do we resolve that? So nirvana is our deepest desire to resolve that issue and to come to peace with it. Actually, it's our deepest desire, not just the people in this room, but everyone in the world wants that. We seek it out in different ways. How do we find security in this world that seems chaotic in some ways? Where's our security? So, going back again, he says, because a Buddha is in birth and death, there is no birth and death. That means we're intimately connected to birth and death, so intimately that we're not observing it as an outside event. In other words, if you look at yourself while you're sitting zazen, and you are aware, and that's all Buddha means, is awareness, just awareness. If you are aware of the very moment when the birth of an idea arises, the very moment when some idea comes into your mind, you're intimately connected with it. And you don't see it as a concept called birth. You're just there with that arising, be it an idea or an emotion, a feeling, a perception. If we're intimate with that, we're not creating an idea about our life. We're just living it there. Then he also says, it is also said, because a Buddha is not in birth and death, a Buddha is not deluded by birth and death. So that means we're not deluded by the comings and goings of things, the arisings of this or the falling away of that. We're not deluded. Sometimes the birth is the birth of a very angry feeling or some feeling of resentment. We see it arising and we see it falling away. But we're not deluded by it. We're not carried away by it. We're not deluded by birth and death. We just see these things arising and falling. So we don't have to, if someone says something disrespectful toward us, we don't have to respond in a disrespectful way back. We're not deluded by it. If you search for a Buddha outside this birth and death, it will be like trying to go to the southern country of Yue with your spear heading towards the north. That's like saying it's trying to go toward Canada with your automobile facing toward Louisiana. You can't get to Canada if your car's heading toward Louisiana. The spear is something, you know, you have on a cart. In his time, you know, faced this way. So UA was somewhere, I don't know, south or north, whatever. You get the thing. Or like trying to see the Big Dipper while you are facing south. So if you search for a Buddha outside this birth and death, which means birth and death is just the arising and vanishing of everything that's happening right in front of us right now. All of our perceptions, our feelings, formations. If we search for some Buddha outside of this moment that we're living in, we'll never find it. It's only in this moment that's where everything is coming up, where we find Buddha, find emancipation, find our life, find our peace. It's only here. It's not outside of this. Just understand that this birth and death is itself nirvana. There is nothing such as birth and death to be avoided. There is nothing such as nirvana to be sought. So this is really a very subtle practice. Because if we do zazen, this is why we do zazen, basically. Why we do the practice of meditation is just to sit down and make our life very simple for a little bit of time. Just to be, all we're making the effort to do is just to be here. Understand? We're just, for the period of time that we're meditating, we're just sort of making this concrete effort just to be here. But we realize that there's something not particularly easy about that. Because even if we make a very firm resolve, we say, this time I'm just going to do it. This period of zazen is going to be different. I'm ready. I'm prepared. I've done my practice. This time I'm going to do it. But you sit down, and then about 3 or 4 seconds later, wait a minute. I made the resolve that I'm just going to be here. I'm not going to be here and think about things. I'm just going to be here without thinking about being here. And I'm not going to seek nirvana or anything. But what happens, maybe we have some degree of success of actually just being here. And maybe we can sit here for 3 or 4 minutes and actually not even have a thought. Not even one thought about anything. Well, about that time, something happens. It only takes about two... Actually, you know how long it takes? It takes about 10 seconds in my experience. 10 seconds of actually not having a thought. And what do we think then? We think... Yeah. Or... That's one thing we might think. Another thing we might think is, you know, I'm ready for nirvana now. I'm ready for nirvana. This is pretty darn nice. Sitting here without, there's nothing. The world basically has stopped. Something stopped. All the ceaseless or endless, ceaseless churning that just continuously goes on and on and on, which is our habituated pattern, stops. And it doesn't take long for it to stop before some huge desire comes up. And it's called a desire for enlightenment. That's why I believe, our deepest desire is for enlightenment. Because right at that place, you have to let go of that desire for enlightenment. So that's why he says there is nothing such as nirvana to be desired. So then he says it is a mistake to suppose that birth turns into death. So that goes back to our previous discussion. But all there is just continuous change. It's not one thing turning into another thing. It's just the arising of this, and on the arising of this is the arising of that. And on the cessation of this is the cessation of that. That's what the Buddha taught. If you try to exclude this birth and death, you lose the life of Buddha. So this means what things in our life that arise that are unpleasant. What's unpleasant that comes? We have to be open to receiving absolutely everything. But there's some things we say, no, that's not it. like if we do for instance, we might live out in the world where everything's very, very busy and confusing, and then we come to a Zen center or a monastery and think, okay, this is where things are going to be okay. We might have that thought. But then things start to happen in the monastery that are just about exactly the same thing that happens out in the world. People start getting mad at each other, and we start fighting a little bit, and or a lot. But this is why the Buddha's, what Dogen's saying, if we try to exclude that, we lose the life of Buddha. It's right there in those ugly, ugly things that we have to face. How do we receive that? Where we understand what the life of Buddha is. That's what Buddha's life was about. Not turning away anything and not chasing after anything. I've been reading a book, or I actually read it, called Buddha's Brain. And he doesn't really talk too much about Buddha's brain, but he does talk about we ourselves as human beings might consider that we have a very sophisticated operating system relative to other species in the world. But I'm not convinced. I think we're, in so many ways, just like basic animals, in which there's two switches, and one's pleasant, unpleasant. It's just we're continually navigating our way through the world, and what feels good and pleasant, we go to. We move that way, and as moment by moment by moment, moving toward the unpleasant, we have something unpleasant over here, we move away from. And we have a whole really sophisticated psychology, you know, that's way above all that, explaining it all. But really, it's just pleasant, unpleasant. That's going, underneath, where we're not even aware of. But that's why we actually sit down, getting back to Zazen. Because this is where we find out things about us, ourselves. It's not a mystical practice, really. All it is, we sit down and we be quiet. And this is like the simplest activity a human being can do. Just sit here. Just sit. That's it. And then when we find out, well, this just sitting here is not easy. There's something that's difficult to actually just sit here. Then we wonder, you know, well, what about all the other things we do that are so complicated? Can we really do those things? Are we really doing those things if we can't even just sit here? So all this sitting activity is about is just becoming intimate with ourselves. Sometimes it's not just always the case that when we sit down we feel a lot better afterwards. Not always. It really depends what's going on in your life. Are you in a lot of pain? Maybe when you sit down, you'll actually experience that pain more than if you don't sit. The point is we feel better because we've actually just experienced who we are, who and what we are, even if it's painful. It's better to know that we're painful and experience the pain rather than not experience it. Because the pain's still there. The pain just has to be experienced. That's the point of pain. There is a simple way to become Buddha. When you refrain from unwholesome actions, not attached to birth and death, and are compassionate toward all sentient beings, respectful to seniors and kind to juniors, not excluding or desiring anything, with no designing thoughts or worries, you will be called a Buddha. Do not seek anything else. Well, he doesn't say an easy way. He says a simple way. It's simple, but not so easy. Just refrain from doing anything wrong. That's all you have. That's all you got to do. Simple. Once I read in the Nikayas, the oldest writings, recorded writings, asserted by the scholars of the Buddha, it said, "What's the right effort?" You know, someone asked Buddha, "What's the right effort we should make?" And he said, "Well, you know, all those things that you do that are really good for you, continue to do those things. Do you know the things you do that are not good to do, that you do? Stop doing those things. Do you know the things that you could be doing that would be really good for you to do that you don't do? Start doing those things. And do you know about the things that you don't do that you could be doing that would be really bad for you? Don't start doing those things." That's right up. I was kind of disappointed in the answer. Jeez. Can it be more... I mean, I know that. So. Katagiri Roshi said in one of his books, "If we say, 'I am not perfect, I am immature, I wish I could be more mature,' this is already dualistic understanding. In Buddhism, it's not real practice. Real practice is that we already are a great being. So, this is how kind of the deep part of our mind that's working, that we will encounter if we sit in meditation, do this practice. Basically, there's something deep inside of us, and this was confirmed also by this book, Buddha's Brain, he's a neuroscientist, about there's something that believes we're not okay. We're not okay the way we are. We've got to change something. Something's got to be different. And so it's our practice to just be okay right here, right now, not longing for something other than just what this is called myself. I read something by St. John of the Cross, which I also think shows the same thing. And he said it's people's greatest fear that God has abandoned them. In other words, it's our greatest fear that for me, God's not here completely. You know, either by the circumstances by which I was born into, you know, and I didn't get enough nurturing from my parents or something or this or something that's just inherently wrong about me, God won't be there for me. And we think the same thing about Buddha or enlightenment. It's just not here for me. And so this is a very, very basic challenge we have as human beings. How do we transform that? I'll read one more little story. It's a short one. A monk asked the Zen teacher Joshu, "I wonder if a person of true practice can be perceived by gods and demons or not." Joshu said, "They can perceive the person." The monk said, "Where is the fault?" Joshu said, "Faults are where they are looked for." The monk said, "In that case, it is not practice." Joshu said, "It is practice." So this is a very subtle, subtle kind of way in which we need to transform our practice into this kind of a story. Because I wonder if a person of true practice can be perceived by gods and demons or not. Gods and demons are this birth and death. Gods are the wonderful things that happen to us in our life. And demons are demons. We all have our own experience of demons, so I won't elaborate. Joshua said, basically he's looking at this person. Joshua doesn't go into a conceptual world. So the monk is saying, what about me? What about me? But he doesn't receive an affirmation from the teacher. He says, yeah, gods and demons can perceive you. You're not in this lofty state beyond gods and demons. So the monk says, where's the fault? Where is the fault? He says, well, faults are just wherever you look for them. Wherever you look for them, be that in you or other people, wherever you look, you can find fault if you want. It's where they're looked for. The monk said, in that case, it's not true practice. But Joshua says, no, that's the practice. See that. See that in your mind. Where are the faults? Where do you think something isn't right about something? It isn't to mean we ignore anything. That's why we don't turn away from things. We completely are intimate with everything that's arising. Karage Roshi also said, he said Suzuki Roshi's final words were, it's all over. Karage Roshi's statement about that says, all over means he touched the core of human life. So, this means, this is how we need to live. I remember when I was in eighth grade, I had a track coach. He was kind of a mean guy. But anyway, I remember something he said that made an impression on me. Because we'd do our little things, whatever they were. My day, it was the 220-yard thing or the 440 quarter mile or whatever. I think it's changed since then. But anyway, we'd get... You know, we'd do our race, and we get to the end, and we'd get about 10 feet past the finish line. We'd turn around, what was my time, coach? What was my time? And he said to us, he says, if there's anything that drives me nuts, it's for you boys to ask me what your time was, you know, like a few seconds just after you ran the race. That means you weren't giving it your best. If you give it your best, you have no interest in what your time was. You are just spent. You gave it your best. It's over. It means you had a whole lot of extra energy you weren't using to run that race. If you got to turn around and ask what your time was. You understand? It's like this. It's like the same is true for our practice. If you know, you... If we do a certain thing and a little later, you know, I mean, afterwards, we say, how did I do? How did I do? Did I do good? Well, if you're asking me, probably you could have done better. Well, that's all I really have to say. We should end at 11, correct? Not later, but so I guess we could have a few minutes if somebody has any comments, questions, and I always add rebuttal. So.
So I think Suzuki Roshi said things are perfect as they are, but there's always room for improvement.
Could have been. Yeah. I'm sure he probably said that. Yeah.
That's what you're saying. Isn't that looking for fault? Looking for what's wrong?
The always room for improvement. I think what that means too is we can't cling to an idea of perfectness, because that might be not helpful. So we have to recognize where some things need to be addressed and how we need to change our behaviors. We encounter that. Well, we can encounter that in a lot of situations where there's commitment. Because if we make a commitment either to a group of people or to our work, little by little, we can't escape. If there's some patterns of behavior that we have that aren't conducive to harmony, so. We might have to, we find that in the monastery sometimes. Although I should point out, our name is not a monastery.
Oh. Okay.
Yeah. We have we call it a Hokyoji Zen practice community. So, I don't live particularly a monastic life, so I didn't want to have monastery attached to my practice, to the practice center that I'm resident teacher of. So, but anyway, even though it's a resident, what do they call it? A community, practice community, still things come up like can happen in a monastery because we're compacted. We don't go home. it's like, oh, this is great. Now we just all go to bed and we wake up and do it again tomorrow. And after a while, you know, we're going to get it on each other's nerves in a certain kind of way, right? So as wonderful it is over the short run when we actually commit to living closely with each other. And really, my feeling is it doesn't matter. Right now there's four people who live there. It says it doesn't matter which four people it would be in the entire world. You know, I could pick them out, hand choose them, who I wanted. And we'd wind up in the same place. So, of needing to always look at our relationships. So, that's why there's room to move forward. Actually, this book, Buddha's Brain, is interesting in that it tells this little story that before there was agrarian societies, when we were all hunters and gatherers, that the most effective way human beings could survive and procreate was to be fierce fighters with other groups. In other words, this was some research done, but the best effective group was about 150 people together. And they could be fierce fighters for the other groups, yet the ones that could communicate internally within their group best also were the most likely to survive. So it's like, to me, there's a still evolution. Like those groups that could communicate with each other better could defeat their enemies better. Now, not that it's our goal, you know, to defeat other Zen centers or something. But it's like, this is the evolution of human beings. It's part of our evolution, how we can get along with each other. Our brain changes in addressing conflict, resolving conflict within our internal group. We actually change. So it's a very, very interesting. So I feel that. I mean, I feel I'm evolving at Hokyoji because I have the practice in a way I've never had to practice before, so closely with other people. Usually, you know, I've had these little escape routes here and there, you know, but no more. I don't have it so easily. I got to work harder to find them. So. But anyway, any other questions, comments? All thinking is dualistic. It's seriously speaking, it is. For instance, if you think about something, who's the subject? You. You become the subject. Even if you're thinking about your parents or whatever, you're ultimately the subject. Right? It's all you're thinking is about you. Ultimately, it's kind of like when you have dreams. You know, it's like you might think, oh, I dreamt that, you know, somebody did this to me or whatever. You know, and psychologists, you know, we can see in dreams. Well, you know, that's really not about the other person. It's what's going on in your mind. It's pretty easy, but so is our ordinary thinking, our awake thinking. It's just about us. So when we have as ourself the subject, there's always an object. So that's the dualism. So the only way we can so we practice just not thinking. And it doesn't mean that we're anything wrong about thinking, because we use our thinking. But we practice to not be caught by it or deluded by it. It could just be, it's useful for under certain conditions, but, you know, about 99.9% of the time it isn't. Don't you think? For instance, when you examine a period of zazen that you do, I mean, how many of those thoughts, you know, are really, you know, we need to hang on to that thought. We need to publish it, you know. It's also the case for me these days when I'm in a zazen and I think, it's like every single one of these thoughts I've thought before, you know. There's no new thoughts anymore. So it's like they're just getting so boring, you know, just so boring. You just think the same thoughts over and over and over. It's just, you know, slight differentiation, slight variances, like the sentence is exactly the same except you change the name of the person or something. Or, you know, you change the preposition or something. So you've just thought them all. And basically what this indicates is a kind of suffering. Kind of suffering because we're really getting tired of these thoughts. You know, we'd like to experience something other, but they just don't stop. You know. So we work with that right there. And they don't really stop until we're tired of them. You know, until they really don't hold in, until we're not infatuated with them anymore. Until we can actually see the pain of thinking them. It's like an addiction. We're kind of addicted to our thinking. We can make a lot of analogies to it, like addiction to alcohol or something. We can say, for instance, we can say, I'll just have two drinks. Well, we don't know what those two drinks will lead to, for one thing. So you just think, I'm just going to have two thoughts. I'll have this one and then the one that follows. But then we don't know what's going to really happen when that second one kicks in. It might kick a third one in and a fourth one. And then all of a sudden, you know, we've had 25 thoughts in a row. Mm-hmm. So, but there's, just like if we wouldn't take that first drink, there's a way that's something painful in not taking that first drink. Right? Something, you know, you want to, but you say, no, I'm not going to. So there's some pain there. It's the same with thinking. You want to think that first thought, but I'm not going to. So there's some pain in actually not thinking that thought. Or there's a situation where you've thought three thoughts in a row, and you see that you've thought some thoughts, and you think, oh, I could keep thinking, or I could stop. Ah, geez, I want to keep thinking. Why do we want to keep thinking? Well, because these are my own beautiful thoughts. These are my beautiful, beautiful thoughts. They're my own. I love them. The Buddha talked about a craving. And he said, one of our cravings is a craving for existence. Just a craving for existence. Every time you think a thought that is I as a subject, that's a craving for existence. I, a craving, just craving to exist. You know, Descartes says, I think, therefore I am. Is that craving? We say, or I say, I think, therefore I am thinking. It doesn't mean it. It's just, I think, therefore I'm thinking. That's it. That's the only thing we can draw.
Well, I have to tell this story. I have a friend named Megan who has a 5-year-old son, Theo. And she sometimes relates conversations that take place at the breakfast table. The other day, Theo said, last night I had an eye dream. Megan said, well, what's an eye dream? It's a dream you have with your eyes. And we were horses. Sorry.
That's all right. It's all right with me. Well, so we need to find, I think, where this I, from the different I, is created. Where is this thing called I created? Where's its birth? I told a story once when I was a few number of years old. I don't know, it's 4, 5, or 6, but I asked my mom, where did I come from? Where did I come from? I know I remember asking the question because she stopped everything she was doing. And my mother never stopped what she was doing when I asked her questions. She just kept going because I asked her thousands of them. But this time she stopped, you know. And I realized, of course, now she had read some book, you know, about what do you say to your kid when they ask about sex, you know. But I wasn't asking about sex. I just said, Mommy, where did I come from? Like, where did I come from? And so she gave me this long, complicated answer about Mommy and Daddy and this and that. And I said, what? Okay. It was a very strange thing. I thought, why? And she's stopped everything she was doing to answer my question, and she's talking about these things. I don't know what she's talking about. So I kind of scratched my head and walked away. But it's interesting. You know, I remember the situation because it was so unusual. But anyway, what I want to emphasize is that original question. Where did I come from? Where does this thing called I, where does it come from? It's coming out of this moment, right from this place. But, you know, it's so solidly formed now in our big old brains that we don't see it like a 3 or 4 or 5 year old. So we need to go back to that place. Where does this I come from? Okay, well, I think we're approaching the time to stop. So thank you very much.